Welcome to Night 24 of the 1001 Nights podcast. Each episode, we bring you the ancient mythologies of the Arabian Nights, as reinterpreted by modern authors. However, this week, for the two-part season finale of Season 1, we are bringing you a story from the 1001 Nights as written in the 1001 Nights, not a reinterpretation, but the actual story. And for this special occasion, we have a guest narrator, BJ Harrison. He has a podcast of his own called the Classic Tales Podcast. He reads wonderful works of fiction and brings them to life. So we're very excited to have him on the podcast. The story that he's going to be reading is called The Tale of the Two Viziers, and it has a couple other names as well. This is one of the first stories I ever heard from the 1001 Nights, and it's incredibly long, which is why we are not having an author reinterpret it. It's just too much for an author to have to adapt the whole thing. It's almost like an entire chapter unto itself. So we thought, what a wonderful opportunity to have a new narrator come on and read a story as it was written. It will be delivered in a classic audiobook style, so we will not have sound effects, but please enjoy, sit back, relax, and let him take you into the 1001 Nights as they were originally told.
There was once in the land of Egypt a just and pious king who loved the poor and companied with the learned. And he had a vizier, a wise and experienced man, well versed in affairs and in the art of government. This vizier, who was a very old man, had two sons, as they were two moons. Never was seen their like for beauty and grace. The elder called Shemseddin Mohammed, and the younger Nuruddin Ali. But the younger excelled his brother in comeliness and fair favor, so that folk heard of him in distant lands and journeyed to Egypt to get sight of him. After a while, the vizier died, to the great grief of the sultan, who sent for his two sons and invested them with robes of honor, saying,
"Let not your hearts be troubled, for you shall stand in your father's stead and be joint viziers of Egypt."
At this they were glad and kissed the earth before him and mourned for their father a whole month, at the end of which time they entered upon the vizierate and the government passed into their hands as it had been in those of their father, each ruling for a week at a time. Whenever the sultan went on a journey, they took it in turns to accompany him. And the two brothers lived in one house, and there was perfect accord between them. It chanced one night that the sultan proposed setting out on a journey on the morrow, and the elder, whose turn it was to attend him, was sitting talking with his brother, and said to him,
"Oh, my brother, it is my wish that we both marry and go into our wives on the same night."
"O my brother," replied Nuruddin, "do as thou wilt, I will conform to thee."
So they agreed upon this, and Shemseddin said,
"If it be the will of God that we both marry on the same night, and our wives be brought to bed on the same day, and thy wife bear a boy, and mine a girl, we will marry the children to one another, for they will be cousins."
"O my brother," asked Nuruddin, "what dowry wilt thou require of my son for thy daughter?"
Quoth the other,
"I will have of him 3,000 dinars, and 3 gardens, and 3 farms, for it would not be fitting that he bring her a smaller dowry than this."
When Nuruddin heard this, he said,
"What dowry is this thou wilt impose on my son? Knowest thou not that we are brothers, and both by God's grace viziers and equal in rank? It behooves thee to offer thy daughter to my son without dowry, or if thou must have a dower, it should be something of nominal value for mere show. For thou knowest the male to be more worthy than the female, and my son is a male, and our memory will be preserved by him, not by thy daughter. But I see thou wouldst do with me according to the saying, if thou wouldst drive away a purchaser, ask him a high price, or as did one, who, being asked by a friend to do him a favour, replied, in the name of God I will comply with thy request, but not till tomorrow. Whereupon the other answered him with this verse, when one of whom a favour's asked postpones it till next day, 'tis to a man who knows the world as if he said him nay. Quoth Shemseddin, verily, thou errest, in that thou wouldst make thy son more worthy than my daughter, and it is plain that thou lackest both judgment and manners. Thou talkest of thy share in the vizierate, when I only admitted thee to share with me in pity for thee, not wishing to mortify thee, and that thou mightest help me. But since thou talkest thus, by Allah, I will not marry my daughter to thy son, though thou pay down her weight in gold. When Nuruddin heard this, he was angry and said, and I will never marry my son to thy daughter. I would not accept him as a husband for her, answered the other. And were I not bound to attend the Sultan on his journey, I would make an example of thee. But when I return, I will let thee see what my dignity demands. When Nuruddin heard this speech from his brother, he was beside himself for rage, but held his peace and stifled his vexation. And each passed the night in his own place, full of wrath against the other. As soon as it was day, the Sultan went out to Giza and made for the pyramids, accompanied by the vizier Shemseddin, whilst Nuruddin arose, sore enraged, and prayed the morning prayer. Then he went to his treasury, and taking a small pair of saddlebags, filled them with gold. And he called to mind his brother's words, and the contempt with which he had treated him, and repeated the following verses. Travel, for you shall find new friends in place of those you leave, and labor, for in toil, indeed, the sweets of life reside. Nor gain nor honor comes to him who idly stays at home. So leave thy native land behind, and journey far and wide. Oft have I seen a stagnant pool corrupt with standing still. If water run, 'tis sweet, but else grows quickly putrefied. If the full moon were always high and never waned nor set, men would not strain their watchful eyes for it at every tide. Except the arrow leave the bow, 'twill never hit the mark, nor will the lion chance on prey if in the copse he bide. The aloes in its native land a kind of firewood is, and precious metals are but dust whilst in the mine they hide. The one is sent abroad and grows more precious straight than gold. The other's brought to light and finds its value magnified. Then he bade one of his people saddle him his mule with a padded saddle. Now she was a dapple mule, high-backed, like a dome builded upon columns. Her saddle was of cloth of gold, and her stirrups of Indian steel, her housings of Isfahan velvet, and she was like a bride on her wedding night. Moreover, he bade lay on her back a carpet of silk, and strap the saddlebags on that, and spread a prayer rug over the whole. The man did as he bade him, and Nuruddin said to his servants, I have a mind to ride out a pleasuring towards Kelubia, and I shall lie 3 nights abroad, but let none of you follow me, for my heart is heavy. Then he mounted the mule in haste, and set out from Cairo, taking with him a little victual,
and made for the open country. About midday, he reached the town of Belbeis, where he alighted and rested himself and the mule. Then he took out food and ate and fared on again in the direction of the desert, after having bought victual and fodder for the mule in the town. Towards nightfall, he came to a town called Sadia, where he alighted and took out food and ate, then spread the carpet on the ground, and laying the saddlebags under his head, slept in the open air, for he was still overcome with anger. As soon as it was day, he mounted and rode onward, till he reached the city of Jerusalem, and thence to Aleppo, where he alighted at one of the khans, and abode 3 days, to rest himself and the mule. Then, being still intent upon travel, he mounted, and setting out again, he knew not whither, journeyed on without ceasing, till he reached the city of Bassora, where he alighted at a certain khan, and spread out his prayer carpet, after having taken the saddlebags off the mule's back, and given her to the porter that he might walk her about. As chance would have it, the vizier of Bassora, who was a very old man, was sitting at a window of his palace opposite the khan, and saw the porter walking the mule up and down. He remarked her costly trappings, and took her to be a mule of parade, of such as are ridden by kings and viziers. This set him thinking, and he became perplexed, and said to one of his servants,
"Bring me yonder porter."
So the servant went and returned with the porter, who kissed the ground before the vizier, and the latter said to him,
"Who is the owner of that mule, and what manner of man is he?"
"O my lord," replied the porter, "he is a comely young man of the sons of the merchants, grave and dignified of aspect."
When the vizier heard this, he rose at once, and mounting his horse, rode to the khan, and went in to Nuradin, who, seeing him making towards himself, rose, and went to meet him and saluted him. The vizier bade him welcome to Bassora, and dismounting, embraced him and made him sit down by his side, and said to him,
"O my son, whence comest thou, and what dost thou seek?"
"O my lord," answered Nuradin, "I come from the city of Cairo,"
and told him his story from beginning to end, saying,
"I am resolved not to return home till I have seen all the towns and countries of the world."
When the vizier heard this, he said to him,
"O my son, follow not the promptings of thy soul, lest they bring thee into peril. For indeed the lands are waste, and I fear the issues of fortune for thee."
Then he let load the saddlebags and the carpets on the mule, and carried Nuradin to his own house, where he lodged him in a pleasant place, and made much of him, for he had conceived a great affection for him. After a while he said to him,
"O my son, I am an old man, and have no male child, but God has given me a daughter, who is thy match for beauty, and I have refused many suitors for her hand. But love of thee has caught hold upon my heart. So wilt thou accept of my daughter to thine handmaid, and be her husband? If thou consent to this, I will carry thee to the Sultan of Bassora, and tell him that thou art my brother's son, and bring thee to be appointed vizier in my stead, that I may keep the house. For by Allah, my son, I am a very old man, and I am weary."
When Nuradin heard the vizier's proposal, he bowed his head a while, then raised it and answered,
"I hear and obey."
At this the vizier rejoiced and bade his servants decorate the great hall, in which they were wont to celebrate the marriages of nobles. Then he assembled his friends and the notables of the kingdom and the merchants of Bassora, and said to them,
I had a brother who was vizier in Cairo, and God vouchsafed him 2 sons, whilst to me, as you know, he has given a daughter. My brother proposed to me to marry my daughter to one of his sons, to which I consented, and when my daughter came at a marriageable age, he sent me one of his sons, this young man now present, to whom I purpose now to marry her, for he is better than a stranger, and that he shall go into her in my house this night. After all, if he please, he shall abide with me, or if he please, he shall return with his wife to his father.
The guests replied, It is well seen of thee. And they looked at Nur ad-Din and were pleased with him. So the vizier sent for Qadis and witnesses, and they drew up the marriage contract, after which the servants perfumed the guests with incense and sprinkled rose water on them, and they drank sherbet of sugar and went away. Then the vizier bade his servants take Nur ad-Din to the bath, and sent him a suit of the best of his own clothes, besides cups and napkins and perfume burners, and all else that he required. So he went to the bath, and when he came out and put on the suit, he was like the moon on the night of her full. Then he mounted his mule, and returning to the vizier's palace, went in to the latter and kissed his hands. The vizier welcomed him and said to him,
Arise, go in to thy wife this night, and tomorrow I will carry thee to the sultan, and I pray God to bless thee with all manner of good.
So Nur ad-Din left him and went in to his wife, the vizier's daughter. To return to his brother Shams ad-Din. When he came back to Cairo, after having been absent a while with the sultan, he missed his brother, and inquired of his servants, who said,
On the day of thy departure with the sultan, thy brother mounted his mule, caparisoned as for state, saying, I am going towards El Kayubia, and shall be absent a day or two, for I am heavy of heart, and let none follow me. Then he rode away, and from that time to this we have heard nothing of him.
Shams ad-Din was concerned at his brother's absence, and became exceedingly uneasy when he found that he did not return, and said to himself,
This is because I spoke harshly to him that night, and he has taken it to heart and gone away, but I must send after him.
Then he went into the king, and acquainted him with what had happened, and he wrote letters and dispatched couriers to his deputies in every province. But after a while they returned without having been able to come to any news of Nur ad-Din, who had by this time reached Bassorah. So Shams ad-Din despaired of finding his brother, and said,
Indeed, I went beyond all bounds in what I said to him, with reference to the marriage of our children. Would it had not been so. This all comes from my lack of sense and judgment.
Soon after this he sought in marriage the daughter of a merchant of Cairo, and took her to wife, and went into her, as it happened by the will of God the Most High, that so he might carry out what he had decreed to his creatures, on the very night on which Nur ad-Din went into the vizier's daughter of Bassorah. Moreover, it was as the two brothers had said, for their wives conceived by them and were brought to bed on the same day. The wife of Shams ad-Din of a daughter never was seen in Cairo a fairer than she, and the wife of Nur ad-Din of a son, than whom a handsomer was never seen in his time. They named the boy Bedr ad-Din Hassan, and his grandfather, the vizier of Bassorah, rejoiced in him and gave feasts and public entertainments, as for the birth of a king's son. Then he took Nur ad-Din and went up with him to the sultan. When Nur ad-Din came in presence of the king, he kissed the ground before him, and repeated the following verses, for he was facile of speech, firm of soul, and abounding in good parts and natural gifts.
May all delights of life attend thee, O my lord, and mayest thou live as long as night and morning be. Lo, when men's tongues recall thy magnanimity, the age doth leap for joy, and time claps hands for glee.
The Sultan rose to receive them, and after thanking Nur ad-Din for his compliment, asked the vizier who he was. The vizier replied,
"This is my brother's son."
And the Sultan said,
"How comes it that we have never heard of him?"
"Oh, my lord the Sultan,"
answered the vizier,
"know that my brother was vizier in Egypt and died, leaving two sons, whereof the elder became vizier in his father's stead, and the younger, whom thou seest, came to me. I had sworn that I would give my daughter in marriage to none but him, so when he came I married him to her. Now he is young, and I am old. My hearing grows dull, and my judgment fails. Wherefore I pray our lord the Sultan to make him vizier in my room, for he is my brother's son, and the husband of my daughter. And he is apt for the vizierate, being a man of sense and judgment."
The Sultan looked at Nur ad-Din and was pleased with him, so granted the vizier's request and appointed him to the vizierate, presenting him with a splendid dress of honor and one of his choicest mules, and allotting him stipends and allowances. Nur ad-Din kissed the Sultan's hands and went home, he and his father-in-law, rejoicing greatly and saying,
"This is of the good fortune of the new-born Hassan."
Next day he presented himself before the king and repeated the following verses.
"New favors attend thee each day of thy life, and fortune to counter the craft of thy foes. May thy days with God's favor be white to the end, and black be their days with misfortune and woes."
The Sultan commanded him to sit in the vizier's place, so he sat down and applied himself to the business of his office, examining into the folk's affairs and giving judgment on their suits, after the usage of viziers, whilst the Sultan watched him and wondered at his wit and good sense and judgment. Wherefore he loved him and took him into favor. When the divan broke up, Nur ad-Din returned to his house and related what had passed to his father-in-law, who rejoiced. Thenceforward, Nur ad-Din ceased not so to apply himself to the duties of the vizierate, that he left not the Sultan day or night, and the latter increased his stipends and allowances, till he amassed great wealth, and became the owner of ships that made trading voyages for his hand, as well as of slaves and servants, black and white, and laid out many estates and made irrigation works and planted gardens. When his son Hassan was 4 years old, his father-in-law, the old vizier, died, and he buried him with great pomp. Then he occupied himself with the education of his son, and when he came to the age of 7, he brought him a doctor of the law to teach him in his own house, and charged him to give him a good education and teach him good manners. So the tutor taught the boy to read and all manner of useful knowledge, after he had spent some years in committing the Quran to memory, and he grew in stature and beauty and symmetry, even as says the poet, "The moon in the heaven of his grace shines full and fair to see, and the sun of the morning glows in his cheeks anemones. He's such a compend of beauties, meseems indeed from him the world all beauty borrows that lives in lands and seas." The professor brought him up in his father's palace, and all his years of youth he never left the house, till one day his father clad him in his richest clothes, and mounting him on one of the best of his mules, carried him to the Sultan, who was struck with his beauty and loved him. As for the people of the city, when he passed through the streets on his way to the palace, they were dazzled with his loveliness, and sat down in the road, awaiting his return, that they might gaze their fill on his beauty and grace and symmetry. The Sultan made much of the boy, and bade his father bring him with him, whenever his affairs called him to the palace. Nuruddin replied, "I hear and obey," and ceased not to carry him to the Sultan's court, till he reached the age of 15, when his father sickened, and calling his son, said to him,
"Know, O my son, that this world is but a temporary abode, whilst the next is an eternal one. Before I die, I wish to give thee certain last injunctions, so pay heed to my words, and set thy mind to understand them."
Then he gave him certain advice as to the proper way of dealing with folk in the conduct of his affairs, after which he called to mind his brother and his native land, and wept for his separation from those he loved. Then he wiped away his tears, and turning to his son, said to him,
"Before I proceed to my parting exhortations, thou must know that thou hast an uncle who is vizier in Cairo, and I left him, and went away without his consent."
Then he took a sheet of paper, and wrote therein all that had happened to him from the day of the dispute, together with the dates of his marriage, and going in to the vizier's daughter, and the birth of his son, after which he folded and sealed the paper, and gave it to his son, saying,
"Keep this paper carefully, for in it is written thy rank and lineage and origin. And if any mishap befall thee, go to Cairo, and ask for thine uncle, and give him this, and tell him that I died in a foreign land, full of longing for him."
So Bedreddin took the paper, and wrapping it in a piece of waxed cloth, sewed it into the lining of his skull cap, and wound the muslin of his turban over it, weeping the while at the thought of losing his father, whilst himself but a boy. Then said Nuruddin,
"I have 5 behests to lay on thee, and the first is that thou be not too familiar with anyone, neither frequent him nor foregather with him overmuch. So shalt thou be safe from his mischief, for in retirement is safety, and I have heard it said by a poet, there is no man in all the world whose love is worth thy trust. No friend who, if fate play thee false, will true and constant be. Wherefore, I'd have thee live apart, and lean for help on none. In this I give thee good advice, so let it profit thee. Secondly, O my son, oppress no one, lest fortune oppress thee. For the fortune of this world is one day for thee and another against thee, and its goods are but a loan to be repaid. As I have heard a poet say, be slow to move and hasten not to snatch thy heart's desire. Be merciful to all, as thou on mercy reckonest. For no hand is there, but the hand of God is over it, and no oppressor but shall be with worse than he oppressed. Thirdly, preserve silence, and let thy faults distract thee from those of other men. For it is said that in silence is safety, and thereon I have heard the following verses. Silence is fair, and safety lies in taciturnity. So when thou speakest, I counsel thee, give not thy tongue the rein, since for one time that thou repent the having held thy tongue, thou shalt of having spoke repent again and yet again. Fourthly, O my son, beware of drinking wine, for wine is the root of all evils and the thief of wit. Guard thyself from it, for the poet says, wine and the drinkers of wine I have put away, and am become of those that of it missay. For wine indeed diverts from the road of right, and to all kinds of evil opens the way. Lastly, O my son, keep thy wealth, that it may keep thee, and watch over it, that it may watch over thee. Squander not thy substance, or thou wilt come to need the meanest of folk. Guard well thy money, for it is a sovereign salve for the wounds of life. Even as says the poet, if wealth should fail, there is no friend will bear thee company. But while thy substance still abounds, all men are friends to thee. How many a foe for money's sake hath companied with me? But when wealth failed beneath my hand, my dearest friend did flee. And Nureddin ceased not to exhort his son, till his spirit departed, and his house became the abode of mourning. The king and all the emirs grieved for him and buried him. But Bedreddin ceased not to bewail his father for 2 whole months, during which time he never left the house, nor did he attend the divan or present himself before the sultan. At last, the latter became wroth with him, and made one of his chamberlains vizier in his stead, and bade him seize on all Nureddin's houses and goods and possessions, and seal them up. So the new vizier went forth to do this, and take Bedreddin Hassan and bring him before the sultan, that he might deal with him as he thought fit. Now there was among the troops one who had been a servant of the deceased vizier, and when he heard this order, he spurred his steed and rode at full speed to Bedreddin's house, where he found him sitting at the gate with downcast head, broken-hearted. So he dismounted, and kissing his hand, said to him, "O my lord and son of my lord, hasten, ere destruction light on thee." When Bedreddin heard this, he trembled and said, "What is the matter?" "The sultan is wroth with thee," answered the other, "and has given orders for thine arrest, and calamity follows hard upon me, so flee for thy life." Quoth Bedreddin, "Is there time for me to go in and take somewhat to stand me instead in my strangerhood?" But the other answered, "O my lord, rise at once and save thyself, whilst it is yet time, and leave thy house." So Bedreddin covered his face with his skirt, and went out and walked on till he came without the city. On his way he heard the people saying that the sultan had sent the new vizier to the late vizier's house to seize on his possessions and take his son Bedreddin Hassan and bring him before him that he might put him to death, and they grieved for him by reason of his beauty and grace. When he heard this, he fled forth at hazard, not knowing whither, and chance led him to the cemetery where his father was buried. So he passed among the tombs, till he came to his father's sepulchre, and entering, sat down, and let fall from over his head the skirt of his cassock, which was made of brocade, with the following lines embroidered in gold on the hem: "Thou whose face with the rainbow might vie, that art bright as the stars of the sky, may thy fortune ne'er fail to be fair, and thy glory for ever be high." As he sat by his father's tomb, there came up a Jew, as he were a money changer, with a pair of saddlebags full of gold, and accosted him, saying,
"Whither away, O my lord? It is near the end of the day, and thou art lightly clad, and bearest the marks of chagrin on thy countenance."
"I was asleep but now," answered Bedreddin, "when my father appeared to me and reproached me for not having visited his tomb, and I awoke, trembling, and came hither at once, fearing lest the day should pass without my paying him a visit, which would have been grievous to me."
"Oh, my lord," said the Jew, "thy father had many ships at sea, whereof some are now due,
and it is my wish to buy of thee the cargo of the first that comes into port for 1,000 dinars.
I will well, answered Bedreddin, whereupon the Jew took out a purse of gold and counted out 1,000 dinars, which he gave to Bedreddin, saying,
Write me an acknowledgment and seal it.
So Bedreddin took pen and paper and wrote the following in double.
The writer, Bedreddin Hassan, son of the vizier Nuruddin of Basra, has sold to Isaac the Jew all the cargo of the first of his father's ships that comes into port, at the price of 1,000 dinars, which he has received in advance.
Then he gave one copy to the Jew, who took it and went away, and put the other in the purse, which he thrust into his waistcloth. And he bethought him of his former estate of honour and consideration, and wept, and repeated the following verses.
Home is no longer home to me, now ye are gone away. Nor are the neighbors neighbors now, after our parting day. The comrade whom I loved while ere, no more a comrade is, and even the very sun and moon, no longer bright are they. Ye went away, and all the world was saddened for your loss, and all the hills and plains grew dark with sorrow and dismay. Oh, that the raven of ill luck that croaked our parting hour may lose his plumes, nor find a nest in which his head to lay. Now my patience fails me for desire, my body wasteth sore. How many avail the hands of death and parting rend in tway? I wonder, will our happy nights come ever back again? Or one house hold us to once more after the olden way? Then he wept sore, and laying his head on his father's tomb, remained plunged in melancholy thought, till drowsiness overcame him, and he fell asleep. He slept on till the moon rose, when his head rolled off the tomb, and he lay on his back, with his face gleaming in the moon. Now the cemetery was haunted by true-believing jinn, and presently a genie came out, and seeing Bedreddin lying asleep, marveled at his beauty and grace, and said, Glory be to God! This can be no other than one of the children of paradise.
Then she rose into the air to fly about, as was her wont, and met an Afrit flying, who saluted her. And she said to him, Whence comest thou?
From Cairo, replied he.
Quoth she,
Wilt thou come with me and look on the beauty of a youth who sleeps in the burial ground yonder?
And he said,
I will well.
So they both flew down to the tomb, and she showed him Bedreddin, saying,
Sawest thou ever the like of this young man?
The Afrit looked at him and exclaimed,
Blessed be God, to whom there is none like. But, O my sister, shall I tell thee what I have seen this day?
What is that?
Asked she, and he answered,
I have seen a young lady in the land of Egypt, who is the counterpart of this youth. She is the daughter of the vizier Shemseddin of Cairo, and is possessed of beauty and grace and symmetry and perfection. When she reached the age of 15, the Sultan of Egypt heard of her, and sending for the vizier, her father, said to him, O vizier, it has come to my knowledge that thou hast a daughter, and I wish to demand her of thee in marriage. O my lord the Sultan, replied the vizier, I prithee accept my excuse to take compassion on my grief, for thou knowest that my brother Nuruddin, who was my partner in the vizierate, left us many years ago and went I know not whither. Now the reason of his departure was that one night we were sitting, talking of marriage and children, when we came to words on the subject, and he was angry with me and went away in his anger. But on the day her mother bore her, 15 years ago, I swore that I would marry my daughter to none but my brother's son. Now, a while ago, I heard that he is lately dead at Bassorah, where he was vizier, after having married the former vizier's daughter and had by her a son, and I will not marry my daughter but to him, in honor of my brother's memory. Moreover, I recorded the date of my marriage and the conception and birth of my daughter and drew her horoscope, and she is destined for her cousin. And there are girls in plenty for our lord the Sultan. Well, when the Sultan heard the vizier's answer, he was exceedingly wroth, and said, "When the like of me demands in marriage the daughter of the like of thee, he confers a favor on her. And thou puttest me off with idle excuses. As my head liveth, I will marry her to the meanest of my serving men, to spite thee." Now the Sultan had a hunchbacked groom, with a hump behind and before, and he sent for him and married him to the vizier's daughter, whether she would or no, and bade carry him in procession and bring him in his bride this very night. Now, I have just come from Cairo, where I left the hunchback at the door of the bath, surrounded by the king's servants, holding lighted flambeaux and making mock of him. As for the vizier's daughter, she sits among her nurses and tirewomen, weeping, for they have forbidden her father access to her. Never, O my sister, saw I one more hideous than the hunchback, whilst the young lady is the likest of all folk to this youth, though she is even handsomer than he.
"Thou liest," replied the genie. "This youth is handsomer than any of his day."
"By Allah, O my sister," replied the Afrit, "the girl I speak of is handsomer than he, but none but he is worthy of her. For they resemble each other as they were brother and sister, or brother's children. Alas, the pity of her with that hunchback."
Then said she, "O my brother, let us take him up and carry him to Cairo, that we may compare him with the damsel and see whether of them is the handsomer."
"I hear and obey," answered the Afrit. "This is right well advised, and I will carry him."
So he took Bedreddin up, and flew with him through the air, accompanied by the Afrite, till he alighted in the city of Cairo and set him down on a stone bench. Then he aroused him, and when he found himself no longer on his father's tomb in Bassorah, but in a strange city, he would have cried out. But the Afrit gave him a cuff and imposed silence on him. Then he brought him a splendid dress and made him put it on, and giving him a lighted flambeau, said to him,
"Know that I have brought thee hither, meaning to do thee a good turn for the love of God. So take this torch and mingle with the people at the door of the bath, and accompany them to the house of the wedding festival. Then advance, and enter the hall, and fear none, but sit down on the right hand of the humpbacked bridegroom, and as often as the tirewomen and singers stop before thee, put thy hand into thy pocket, and thou wilt find it full of gold. Take it out by handsful, and give it to all who come to thee, and spare not, for as often as thou puttest thy hand into thy pocket, thou wilt find it without fail full of gold. So fear nothing, but put thy trust in him who created thee, for all this is not by thine own strength, but by that of God, that his decrees may take effect upon his creatures."
Quoth Bedreddin to himself, "I wonder what is the meaning of all this." and taking the torch, went to the bath, where he found the hunchback already on horseback. So he mixed with the people and moved on with the bridal procession. And as often as the singing women stopped to collect largesse from the people, he put his hand into his pocket, and finding it full of gold, took out a handful and threw it into the singer's tambourine, till it was full of dinars. The singing women were amazed at his munificence, and they and the people wondered at his beauty and grace and the richness of his dress. He ceased not to do thus, till he reached the vizier's palace, where the chamberlains drove back the people and forbade them to enter. But the singing women said, "By Allah, we will not enter unless this young man enter with us, for he has overwhelmed us with his bounties, nor shall the bride be displayed except he be present." So the chamberlains let him pass, and he entered the bridal saloon with the singers, who made him sit down in defiance of the humpbacked bridegroom. The wives of the viziers and emirs and chamberlains were ranged, each veiled to the eyes, and holding a great lighted flambeau in two ranks, extending right and left from the bride's throne to the upper end of the dais, in front of the door from which she was to issue. When the ladies saw Bedreddin, and noted his beauty and grace, and his face that shone like the new moon, they all inclined to him, and the singers said to all the women present, "You must know that this handsome youth has handselled us with naught but red gold, so fail ye not to wait on him and comply with all that he says." So all the women crowded round Bedreddin with their torches and gazed on his beauty and envied him his grace, and each would gladly have lain in his bosom an hour or a year. In their intoxication they let fall their veils from their faces and said, "Happy she who belongs to him or to whom he belongs." And they cursed the humpbacked groom and him who was the cause of his marriage to that lovely lady. And as often as they invoked blessings on Bedreddin, they followed them up with imprecations on the hunchback, saying, "Indeed, this youth, and he alone, deserves our bride. Alas, the pity of her with this wretched hunchback. God's curse be on him and on the sultan, who will have her marry him." Then the singers beat their tambourines and raised cries of joy, announcing the coming of the bride, and the vizier's daughter entered, surrounded by her tire women, who had perfumed her with essences and incensed her, and decked her hair and dressed her in costly robes and ornaments such as were worn by the ancient kings of Persia. Over all, she wore a robe embroidered in red gold, with figures of birds and beasts, with eyes and beaks of precious stones, and feet and claws of red rubies and green beryl, and about her neck was clasped a necklace of Yemen work, worth many thousands of dinars, whose bezels were all manner jewels. Never had Caesar or king of Yemen its like. She seemed, as it were, the full moon, when it shines out on the 14th night, or one of the houris of paradise. Glory be to him who made her so splendidly fair. The women encompassed her as they were stars, and she in their midst as the moon breaking through the clouds. As she came forward, swaying gracefully to and fro, the hunchback rose to kiss her, but she turned from him, and seeing Bedreddin Hassan seated, with all the company gazing on him, went and stood before him. When the folk saw her thus attracted towards Bedreddin, they laughed and shouted, and the singers raised their voices, whereupon he put his hand to his pocket and cast gold by handsful into the tambourines of the singing women, who rejoiced and said, "Would this bride were thine!" At this he smiled, and the people came round him with the flambeau in their hands, whilst the hunchback was left sitting alone, looking like an ape. For as often as they lighted a candle for him, it went out and he abode in darkness, speechless and confounded and grumbling to himself. When Bedreddin saw the bridegroom sitting moping alone, and all the lights and people collected round himself, he was confounded and marveled. But when he looked at his cousin, the vizier's daughter, he rejoiced and was glad, for indeed her face was radiant with light and brilliancy. Then the Tyre women took off the veil and displayed the bride in her first dress of red satin, and she moved to and fro with a languorous grace, till the heads of all the men and women were turned by her loveliness, for she was even as says the excellent poet, like a sun at the end of a cane in a hill of sand. She shines in a dress of the hue of pomegranate flower. She gives me to drink of her cheeks and her honeyed lips, and quenches the flaming fires that my heart devour. Then they changed her dress and displayed her in a robe of blue, and she reappeared like the moon when it bursts through the clouds, with her coal-black hair and her smiling teeth, her delicate cheeks and her swelling bosom, even as says the sublime poet. She comes in a robe the color of ultramarine, blue as the stainless sky unflecked with white. I view her with yearning eyes, and she seems to me a moon of the summer set in a winter's night. Then they clad her in a third dress, and letting down her long black ringlets, veiled her face to her eyes with the superabundance of her hair, which vied with the murkiest night in length and blackness, and she smote all hearts with the enchanted arrows of her glances. As says the poet, with hair that hides her rosy cheeks, even to her speaking eyes, she comes, and I her locks compare unto a sable cloud, and say to her, thou curtainest the morning with the night. But she, not so, it is the moon that with the dark I shroud. Then they displayed her in the fourth dress, and she shone forth like the rising sun, swaying to and fro with amorous languor, and turning from side to side with gazelle-like grace. And she pierced hearts with the arrows of her eyelashes, even as says the poet. A sun of beauty she appears to all that look on her, glorious in arch and amorous grace, with coyness beautified. And when the sun of morning sees her visage and her smile conquered, he hasteneth his face behind the clouds to hide. Then they displayed her in the fifth dress, with her ringlets let down. The downy hair crept along her cheeks, and she swayed to and fro, like a willow wand or a gazelle bending down to drink, with graceful motions of the neck and hips. As says the poet describing her, like the full moon she doth appear, on a calm night and fair, slender of shape, and charming all with her seductive air. She hath an eye, whose glances pierce the hearts of all mankind. Nor can cornelian with her cheeks for ruddiness compare. The sable torrent of her locks fall down unto her hips. Beware the serpents of her curls, I counsel thee, beware. Indeed, her glance, her sides are soft, but nonetheless, alas, her heart is harder than the rock. There is no mercy there. The starry arrows of her looks she darts above her veil. They hit and never miss the mark, though from afar they fare. When I clasp hands about her waist to press her to my heart, the swelling apples of her breast compel me to forbear. Alas, her beauty! It outdoes all other loveliness. Her shape transcends the willow wand and makes the branch despair. Then they unveiled her in the sixth dress, which was green. In this she reached the utmost bounds of loveliness, outvying in slender straightness the tawny spear shaft, and in suppleness and flexile grace the bending branch, whilst the splendors of her face outshone the radiance of the full moon. Indeed, she transcended the fair of all quarters of the world, and all hearts were broken by her loveliness. For she was even as says the poet, a damsel made for love, and decked with subtle grace. you'd say the very sun had borrowed from her face. She came in robes of green, the likeness of the leaf that the pomegranate's flower doth in the bud encase. "How call'st thou this thy dress?" we said to her, and she made answer with a word full of malicious grace. "Breaker of hearts," quoth she, "I call it, for therewith I've broken many a heart among the human race." Then they dressed her in the seventh dress, which was of a color between saffron and orange, even as says the poet, "Scented with sandal and musk and ambergris, lo, she comes. The blended hues of her dress 'twixt orange and saffron show. Slender and shapely she is. Vivacity bids her arise. But the weight of her hips says, sit, or softly and slowly go." When I solicit her kiss and sue for my heart's desire, "Be gracious," her beauty says, but her coquetry answers, "No." They unveiled the bride in all her seven dresses before Bedreddin Hassan, leaving the hunchback sitting by himself. And when she opened her eyes, she said, "Oh, my God, grant that this youth may be my husband, and deliver me from this hump-backed groom." Then they dismissed the company, and all who were present retired, except Bedreddin Hassan and the hunchback, whilst the tire women carried off the bride to undress her and prepare her for the bridegroom. Thereupon the hunchback came up to Bedreddin Hassan and said to him,
"Oh, my lord, thou hast cheered us with thy company tonight and overwhelmed us with thy favour. Wilt thou not now rise and depart?"
"In the name of God," replied Bedreddin, and rising went out of the door, where the Afrit met him, and said to him,
"Stay where thou art, and when the hunchback goes out to the draught house, enter thou the bride chamber, and do not hesitate, but sit down in the alcove, and when the bride comes, say to her, 'Tis I who am thy husband, for the king only played this trick on thee to conjure the evil eye from us, and he whom thou sawest is one of our grooms. Then go up to her and uncover her face and fear nothing, for jealousy hath taken us of this affair, and none is worthy to enjoy her youth but thyself."
As he was yet speaking, the groom came out, and entering the closet, sat down on the stool. Hardly had he done so, when the Afrit appeared to him in the shape of a mouse, issuing from the water trough, and cried, "Queek!" Quoth the hunchback,
"What ails thee?"
And the mouse increased, till it became a cat, and said, "Meow, meow." Then it grew still more, and became a dog, and cried, "Bow, wow!" When the hunchback saw this, he was terrified, and exclaimed,
"Begone, O unlucky one!"
The dog increased and became an ass colt that brayed and cried out in his face, "Hee-haw, hee-haw!" Whereupon the hunchback quaked and cried out,
"Come to my aid, O people of the house!"
But the ass increased and swelled, till it became a buffalo, and barred the way against him, and said in a human voice,
"Out on thee, hunchback, thou stinkard!"
The groom was seized with a colic and sat down on the jakes with his clothes on and his teeth chattering. Quoth the Afrit,
"Is the world so small that thou canst find none to marry but my mistress?"
But he was silent, and the Afrit said,
"Answer me, or I will make thee a dweller in the dust."
"By Allah," replied
the hunchback,
"I am not to blame, for they forced me to marry her, and I knew not that she had a buffalo for a gallant, but I repent to God and to thee. What wilt thou have me do?"
quoth the Afrit.
I swear to thee that if thou leave this place or speak before sunrise, I will wring thy neck. When the sun rises, go thy way, and never return to this house.
So saying, he seized the hunchback and set him upside down against the wall, with his head in the slit and his feet in the air, and said to him,
I will leave thee here and watch thee till sunrise, and if thou stir before then, I will seize thee by the feet and dash out thy brains against the wall.
Meanwhile, Bedreddin Hassan entered the bride chamber and sat down in the alcove. Presently, in came the bride, attended by an old woman, who stopped at the door of the chamber and said,
O father of symmetry, arise and take what God sends thee.
Then the old woman went away, and the bride, whose name was the Lady of Beauty, entered, heartbroken, and saying to herself,
By Allah, I will never yield myself to him, though he kill me.
When she came to the alcove, she saw Bedreddin sitting there, and said,
O my friend, thou here at this hour? By Allah, I was wishing that thou wast my husband, or that thou and the groom were partners in me.
How should the groom have access to thee? Asked Bedreddin. And how should he share with me in thee? Quoth she,
Who is my husband, thou or he?
O Lady of Beauty, replied Bedreddin, all this was only a device to conjure the evil eye from us. Thy father hired the hunchback for 10 dinars to that end, and now he has taken his wage and gone away. Didst thou not see the singers and tire women laughing at him? And how thy people displayed thee before me? When the Lady of Beauty heard this, she smiled and rejoiced and laughed softly. Then she said to him,
Thou hast quenched the fire of my heart. So by Allah, take me and press me to thy bosom.
Now she was without clothes, so she threw open the veil in which she was wrapped and showed her hidden charms. At this sight, desire stirred in Bedreddin, and he rose and put off his clothes. The purse of 1,000 dinars he had received of the Jew he wrapped in his trousers, and laid them under the mattress, then took off his turban and hung it on the settle, remaining in a skull cap and a shirt of fine silk laced with gold. With this arose the Lady of Beauty and drew him to her, and he did the like with her. Then he took her to his embrace, and pointing the engine that batters down the fortalice of virginity, stormed the citadel, and found her an unpierced pearl, and a filly that none but he had ridden. So he took her maidenhead, and enjoyed her flower of youth, nor did he stint to return to the assault till he had furnished 15 courses, and she conceived by him. Then he laid his hand under her head, and she did the like, and they embraced, and fell asleep in each other's arms, whilst the tongue of the case spoke the words of the poet. Cleave fast to her that lovest, and let the envious rail amain, for calumny and envy ne'er to favour love were fain. Lo, the compassionate hath made no fairer thing to see than when one couch in its embrace enfoldeth lovers twain, each to the other's bosom clasped, clad in their own delight, whilst hand with hand and arm with arm about their necks enchain. Lo, when two hearts are straitly knit in passion and desire, but on cold iron smite the folk that chide at them in vain, if in thy time thou find but one to love thee and be true, I read thee cast the world away, and with that one remain. As soon as Bedreddin was asleep, the Afrit said to the Afrite,
Come, Let us take up the young man and carry him back to his place, ere the dawn overtake us, for the day is near.
So she took up Bedreddin, as he lay asleep, clad only in his shirt and skullcap, and flew away with him, accompanied by the Afrit. But the dawn overtook them midway, and the Muezzins began to chant the call to morning prayer. Then God let his angels cast at the Afrit with shooting stars, and he was consumed. But the Afrite escaped and lighted down with Bedreddin, fearing to carry him further, lest he should come to harm. Now, as fate would have it, she had reached the city of Damascus, so she laid Bedreddin down before one of its gates and flew away. As soon as it was day, the gate was thrown open and the folk came out, and seeing a handsome young man clad in nothing but a shirt and skullcap, lying on the ground, drowned in sleep by reason of his much swink of the night before, said, "Happy she with whom this youth lay the night. Would he had waited to put on his clothes." Quoth another,
"A sorry race are young men of family. Belike this fellow but now came forth of the tavern on some occasion or other, but being overcome with drunkenness, missed the place he was making for, and strayed till he came to the city gate, and finding it shut, lay down and fell asleep."
As they were bandying words about him, the breeze blew on him, and raising his shirt, showed a stomach and navel and legs and thighs, firm and clear as crystal, and softer than cream, whereupon the bystanders exclaimed, "By Allah! It is good," and made such a noise that Bedreddin awoke and, finding himself lying at the gate of a city, in the midst of a crowd of people, was astonished, and said to them,
"Oh, good people, where am I, and why do you crowd round me thus?"
"We found thee lying here asleep at the time of the call to morning prayer," replied they, "and this is all we know of the matter. Where didst thou lie last night?"
"By Allah, good people," answered he, "I lay last night in Cairo."
Quoth one,
"Thou hast eaten hashish." And another, "Thou art mad. How couldst thou lie yesternight in Cairo and awake this morning in Damascus?"
"By Allah, good people," rejoined he, "I do not lie to you. Indeed, I lay last night in the city of Cairo, and yesterday I was in Bassorah."
"Good,"
said one, and another, "This youth is mad." And they clapped their hands at him and said to each other, "Alack, the pity of his youth! By Allah, there is no doubt of his madness." Then said they to him, "Collect thyself and return to thy senses. How couldst thou be in Bassorah yesterday and in Cairo last night and yet awake in Damascus this morning?"
But he said, "Indeed, I was a bridegroom in Cairo last night."
"Doubtless thou hast been dreaming," rejoined they,
"and hast seen all this in sleep."
So he bethought himself a while, then said to them,
"By Allah, it was no dream. I certainly went to Cairo, and they displayed the bride before me in the presence of the hunchback. By Allah, O my brethren, this was no dream. Or if it was a dream, where is the purse of gold I had with me, and my turban, and trousers, and the rest of my clothes?"
Then he rose, and entered the town, and passed through its streets and markets. But the people followed him and pressed on him, crying out, "Madman! Madman!" till he took refuge in a cook's shop. Now this cook had been a robber and a sharper, but God had made him repent and turn from his evil ways and open a cookshop. And all the people of Damascus stood in awe of him and feared his mischief. So when they saw Bedreddin enter his shop, they dispersed for fear of him and went their ways. The cook looked at Bedreddin, and noting his beauty and grace, fell in love with him and said to him,
"Whence comest thou, O youth? Tell me thy case, for thou art become to me dearer than my soul."
So Bedreddin told him all that had befallen him from first to last.
And the cook said, O my lord Bedreddin, this is indeed a strange thing and a rare story. But, O my son, keep thy case secret till God grant thee relief. And abide here with me meanwhile, for I am childless and will adopt thee as my son. And Bedreddin answered,
I will well, O uncle.
With this the cook went to the bazaar, rebought him a handsome suit of clothes, and made him put it on, then carried him to the Cadi and formally acknowledged him as his son. So Bedreddin passed in Damascus for the cook's son, and abode with him, sitting in the shop to take the money.
And so we come to the end of part one of our season one series finale, The Tale of the Two Viziers, as read by B.J. Harrison. He did a wonderful job, and I am excited for part two in 2 weeks' time. I hope you are as well. The 1001 Nights podcast is produced by Morgan Dubin and me, Nathan Kane. Scheherazade is played by the incredibly talented Ariel Siegel, who you did not hear tonight because this tale, The Tale of the Two Viziers, was read by B.J. Harrison. B.J. Harrison did us this favor of coming on to be our guest narrator for The Tale of the Two Viziers, and if you liked what you heard here on this episode, check out his podcast, the Classic Tales podcast. It was number 3 when it came out overall for all podcasts in the iTunes store, right behind This American Life. He's been doing it for 8 years and has over 400 episodes with many, many, many 5-star reviews. It's a wonderful resource for classic literature. And as you heard tonight, he does a wonderful job bringing the stories to life. Find BJ on his website at thebestaudiobooks.com. To find out more about the 1001 Nights podcast and to read BJ's compelling history, learning to love audiobooks and then eventually how he began the Classic Tales podcast, find us online at 1001nightspodcast.com. For the season finale of the 1001 Nights podcast, we were going to take the staff out to a wine bar for a nice night just to say thank you for all their hard work. Everyone seemed really excited, except for our sound engineer who strolled into my office and said,
Beware of drinking wine, for wine is the root of all evils and the thief of wit.
All right, that will do it for night 24 of the 1001 Nights podcast. Thank you so much for listening, and good morning.